Good evening, everyone. And it's nice to be sitting back here again, sitting with you Monday night. I've been gone for a month, for those of you who didn't know. And it's very, very sweet. It's very nice to be sitting here with you. I was away for the month teaching retreat at Spirit Rock. Some of the people at the retreat had been sitting February also, so they sat for 2 months. And then 29 people were continuing from 1 month to the next. So some people, 29 people sat for 2 months, silent retreat. And it's really a sweet thing. I've told a few people that, and they say, who can get away for so long? Mm-hmm. And it's really special. It's kind of a privilege to have the opportunity in one's life to take off that kind of time from work and family and all kinds of things, to be able to be engaged in a full-time monastic setting. It's kind of not really monastic, but it's a quiet, silent retreat setting where basically all that goes on is meditation all day. And it was really sweet and really powerful, the effect that that kind of meditation time has on people. And this retreat in particular felt particularly rich and deep and transformative for people. And so I think because of that, being there so much, I don't feel like I want to talk very loud today. My voice is softer than normal. You managing here okay? I could project my voice if you, but then I'd get out of my mood. You know, 1 month. So what I'd like to do this evening is to explore something start off with something that seems very simple, innocently simple, and then to explore it with you and see, try to show you, in a sense, how complex it is and how that complexity might work in our lives. And I start with something as simple as hitting the bell. So I can make a very simple statement now. I can say, I hit the bell. And that seems like a pretty obvious, simple, innocent statement to make. That's what happened. I hit the bell. I struck the bell. But it's possible to look at this a little more carefully, look at the words we use, the activity. We start by the issue of a bell. This is the bell that I struck. And I think in this setting, there's no disagreement that this is a bell. However, the bellness of this bell is understood to be a social construct. It's an idea that we have. And that idea is projected on this piece of metal. And then we use, when we have that idea, the bell, then we can use it as a bell. However, it's a little bit arbitrary to call this a bell. Even though I think it was made to be a bell, designed to be a bell, it's still a little bit arbitrary. It could equally well be a bowl, a Buddhist begging bowl. Some of them are about this size. And the monks would go around with their bowl and collect, monks and nuns, and collect food, alms, in the morning. And it doesn't have to be a bell, it could be a bowl. And if someone used it as a bowl like that, where they pour their Cheerios in there and milk, then it would be a bowl. It could probably work pretty well as a pot, a cooking pot. And you can put it over the fire and cook your oatmeal in it. And it'll probably work. And then it'll be a pot. Hand me the pot. Or you could put flowers in it and it could be the flower vase. See the vase over there? Can you bring it to me and throw out those dead flowers? We call it a vase if it has flowers in it. Or we can have a whole bunch of pens in it. It could be a pen holder. And it'd be a pen holder. And depending how it's used, affects how we label it, how we see it. I once saw a homeless person in San Francisco on the street with a beautiful, probably fairly expensive Japanese bell. I don't know if he had any idea if he knew what he was holding, but he was using it as his begging cup. I don't know where he got it. I didn't ask him. But he was going, you know, going around with his beautiful brass bell. So for him, it was a you know, begging cup or something. So to some extent, we're then, the mind is creating the bellness of the bell. It's an idea the mind forms, and it has that idea when it looks at this piece of metal, sees this metal, thinks, oh, that's a bell. It's an activity of the mind to construct it as a bell. In a sense, you could say that the mind paints this piece of metal with bellness, with the idea of a bell. There are many situations in our life where we are painting reality, painting things with our ideas of what it is or what it should be. And sometimes it's accurate and sometimes it's not. I've known, it's not so uncommon, for, I know, I think for some people, to have a momentary glimpse of something, like a corner of their eye, and they construct something that out there that's not actually there. You see a rope and you think it's a snake. That's the classic example in Buddhism. I once stepped across a 6-foot twig at dusk in a jungle in Thailand. There was this twig, this branch was sticking across the whole road. And I stepped on it, only to find out that the branch was a snake. And then I jumped. But the mind has this amazing ability to construct. That's what the mind does. It's part of what minds do. Is it kind of synthesizes the sensory input that we get, it takes in, and then it constructs something and makes something out of it, and then paints that thing with, in a sense, you paint that reality with a construct. We call this now the meditation hall, but it used to be the sanctuary of a church. And we could take up the carpet and put in good hardwood floor in here, and it could become a dance floor. And we, you know, it could be the stage up there, or it could be the theater. This could be called the theater. If we turned into a, you know, if we changed our minds and decided we weren't into the religion business, but we're into theater instead. And this would be the theater. So to some degree, things are flexible and arbitrary, and the activities of the mind construct what they are. We say what they are, we kind of label them as such. If you turn around then that statement, I strike the bell, at the subject of the sentence, I, it turns out the same thing happens there. It seems innocent enough to say, I strike the bell. Lewis didn't do it. He's sitting there wondering what I'm doing here. You know, I'm the one who struck it. That's innocent. But it's very rare, I think, that a human being uses the word I completely innocently. You know, just I. Usually, there's some kind, we look at ourselves and we see ourselves. There's a kind of a painting process that goes on there, a projection process. There's associations. There's ideas that we build up. What it means to be a self, an I, who I am, based on our history, based on our society, what it tells us about our culture, tells us about I's and selves, and our situation, our role. I hit the bell. I'm in the role of the teacher. So it's the teacher hits the bell, so that means something. And I'm still trying to figure out what it means, except I'm trying to teach you something. But I hit the bell in the role of a teacher. Or Mick hits the bell, and when Mick hits the bell at 8:15, it means that the sitting is over. But if he rang it at 8:35, people wonder, what's, you know. Anyway, so I got kind of carried away. But there's a projection, a painting process that goes on internally. You kind of have some idea of who I am. And it turns out that a lot of our views and ideas about self, about I, are arbitrary or are optional. And they could just as well be different. For those of you who have been lived in different cultures, different countries, you can see how different cultures, societies have different ideas of what it means to be a self. We have particular ones here in the West, kind of Western ideas that we have many in the West. There's so many different cultures here now, but we have some predominant ones. The American idea of individualism, the idea of human rights is very powerful here in the West. They come with a sense of self. in other cultures, they have very different ideas of self. And we scratch our heads sometimes to understand how other cultures understand their society and what it means to be a human being, because it's so foreign to what ours is. Or we judge them by our standards, thinking that, oh, that's a kind of tribal culture where, you know, we measure it by the idea of individuation and being individual and being distinct from everybody, so important. But when the idea of a self in those cultures are tribal and social, and the people really feel that who they are is not an individual, but they're a member of a society, of a family, of a tribe, it's very hard for us to appreciate how their sense of self is so radically different than us. And sometimes we say, oh, you know, that shouldn't be that way. They should individuate or something. So what does it mean to say I? For some people in the Western, kind of in our culture, in Western culture, there's an epidemic of psychological understandings of self. And some of them come with strong emotional feelings, like, oh, I'm inadequate, I'm unworthy, or I'm a kind of person for whom there's a lot at stake depending on how I hit that bell. I mean, there's all these people in this room watching. I've had, you know, and I have had years of Zen training, and I've really, you know, learned, spent a lot of time hitting those bells and trained to hit bells. And so when I hit that bell, I'm showing off, you know, and I need to impress all these people. So the I, when you say I, it can sometimes be quite innocent, but not very far away, there can be all these other ideas about what it means to say I, what it means to be a self. The word I is kind of a magnet for those. When I lived in Japan and was speaking Japanese, trying to learn to speak Japanese, I tried to speak Japanese how you'd speak English. And one of the aspects of English, which I had never really thought about very much, was how much we use personal pronouns, which in Japanese, you can use personal pronouns in Japanese, but you don't use them very often. Who's being spoken about in the sentence is contextual. You understand in context. So, you know, if I said hitting the bell, it's assumed that I'm the one who's hitting the bell. You don't have to say I, because I'm the one who struck it. Or let's go means let us, well, I guess it doesn't work, but so when I was speaking Japanese, I would start, because I was knew how to speak in English, I would start every sentence with the Japanese equivalent of as for me, or I, which is watashi wa, watashi is I, and it's three syllables, you know, so it takes a while to get out, you know, I is just one. And then you have to add this little thing, this preposition wa, as for me, as for I. So watashi wa. And after a while, I became so acutely aware, painfully aware, of how I would start everything with the sentence, with the word I. Self-referential. How much things were self-referential. So if we have the object externally, the external world here, the bell, we can paint it with reality. We paint reality with our concepts and ideas. Internally, we paint it with concepts as well, who we are, who I am. That painting process is an activity. It's in a verb. So what you have here in this sentence is you have three activities going on. I happens to be an activity. It's a construct that we're making about who I am, the I-ness. The hitting is a activity, and the bell here is also in part an activity. It involves the creation of bellness in the mind. So when I say I hit the bell, there are a number of there's more complex things going on in the mind than we initially think. But then we look more carefully. Some people, when they say, make a statement, I hit the bell, don't have an equal valence in all three words. Some people are predisposed to look in one direction more than the other. Some people, when they say, I hit the bell, are predisposed to look at the I part of the statement. everybody's watching me, I better do a good job, this and that, you know. And so I is important. Other people are more predisposed to look externally, outwards, and look at the bell. Wow, that's a great bell. You know, I wonder if I can get a bell like this at home. I wonder where they bought it, and I wonder if I could buy it from IMC, and you know. And so we look externally in the world. Some people tend to look externally, some people internally. Some people are phenomenally self-preoccupied with themselves, and some people, you know, hardly at all. We wish they were sometimes. And they kind of go around, they can focus, you know, on the external world and measuring it and looking at it and analyzing it. Some people might be look more at the activity, the verb, the hitting here. Oh, the hitting, that's what they're looking at. They're really focused on that. They haven't had enough exercise. They've been in a retreat for a month. And, you know, this, you know, finally I get to do some action here. You know, bang, you know. And the hitting is what's important. It's not the eye or the bell, but just the activity. That's what they focus on. And so there's that kind of activity. That kind of activity is going on also in the mind. A choosing of where to put the emphasis on, where the mind is focusing and thinking about when it kind of does this thing. Then there's other things that go on. There are more subtle views or opinions, stories we have about things. So one of the ones that Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on is the construct that something is permanent. A view that something is permanent. Whether it's the bell or the equivalent, whatever's out there, or on ourselves in here. And sometimes there's also the added construct or painting of a situation where, oh, this is permanent or this is stable. So is the bell stable? Is it, you know, a permanent bell? If we accept that the bell is really a construct, and if we change our use of it, it would be something different. Then it's really quite an impermanent phenomena. Its bellness has to be reconstructed all the time. It's a constant reconstruction. There's nothing permanent here that's a bell, but rather it's something the mind has to recreate. But we assume that there's some stability in the bell, in the bellness. If we look internally to ourselves, we can also very easily assume there's some kind of stability here of who we are. And you can perhaps see it more clearly with in other people. You see other people who are kind of holding on to some images of themselves, or some idea of themselves that's old or no longer necessary. And you say, please, you know, you don't have to do that. You don't have to kind of see yourself that way anymore. But it's very hard sometimes to tell someone to let go of a view that they have. Or someone else has a view about you. Once upon a time, 10 years ago, you just happen, in your rare occasions, to be angry. So that person happened to run into you that day. And that person just can't get out of his or her mind that you're an angry person. And whenever that person sees you, you know, they're kind of cautious around you, that angry person. But you haven't been angry in 10 years. Just that's the way the person sees you. You say, please, please don't see me that way. Someone sees you as a spouse. I know people who suffer that, you know, that they're only kind of, they are seeing or talk, people talk to them because they're related to someone. And so they hold an image, an idea of who they are. And that image has a certain kind of stability. Or people are seen as their role. And they're held, fixated as that's the role, that's who you are, is that role. At the end of this retreat at Spirit Rock, it was one of the things the teachers do. During the retreat, we sit up on a stage. So we're kind of towering over everybody in our great authority as teachers, right? And then at the end of the last day of the retreat, all the teachers, there are six of us, we get down from the stage and get down on the floor where everybody else is. And then Jack Kornfield explained that it was our role to be teachers for the retreat. It was a privilege. It was a role that we had. But we don't want to confuse who we are with the role. And so now we want to get down from the high platform, get down on the floor, and then and ask for forgiveness for any ways, knowingly or unknowingly, that we might have harmed people, retreatants in a role as teachers. So kind of bring down level of playing field, step out of the role, and kind of ask for apologies. It was quite touching. There was, you know, all these people started kind of tearing up at the retreat. I mean, sitting quietly for a month and seeing these people who were elevated for a month kind of get down and apologize. It was quite moving. But I think it's very important to kind of pop the bubble of being seen always through the filter of a role. And so role, you know, see someone as a role is also kind of has a stability to it, kind of sense of permanence, at least temporarily. Is it always for everyone's best interest to always see someone through the filter of a role? I know some children sometimes it's a surprise to realize that their parents are not just parents. You know, that they are much richer and wider people than, you know, the mother or father. Wait a minute, you're supposed to be mother. But, you know, they have other roles, other things to do in life besides being mother or father. So internally also, when we look at ourselves, this is much harder to see. We tend to create a certain stability, stable vision or view. This is who I am. Sometimes that's helpful, and often it's not helpful to have that stability of view. When we carry some view, for example, that I'm inadequate, I'm a no good, lousy so-and-so, and that's how we're carrying ourselves around. That is, you know, and it holds some stability like that. That's not a very useful view to hold. Or, you know, to have the idea that, oh, I'm depressed, and this is it. You know, and have some idea, this is kind of have a view of stability, of permanence in the mood that we're having. And I know that I've had that very easily, where I feel kind of grumpy or lousy or something, and I say, uh-oh, this is it. I know when I sat retreats early on, the first day of the retreat was often quite difficult for me. And partly it was just kind of coming down from normal life, you know, we're kind of hyped up in normal life and come down and kind of the purification process and emptying process and, you know, I get a little bit of headache and feel really tired. And one of the phenomena of this first day of the retreat was the conclusion that I would make that this is the way the retreat would be for the whole retreat. I would be this way the whole time. I was doomed for the retreat. And it was just a first day phenomena. But this idea of permanence, looking at this is the way things are. This is how it is. I'm this way. So I hit the bell can have infused in it views of permanence, views of stability. I, bell, that maybe are not inherently there. So there's the subjective world, the I. There's the objective world, the bell or the things outside. There's the orientation we might have towards it. Some people are oriented towards the world as a place that's threatening. Some people are oriented towards the world as if the world is a place that you can desire and want to get. Some people are, there's an orientation we have towards the world that may be quite deep, kind of underlying structure of how we see ourselves in the world, who we are, what the world is, and the connection to it. Some people have very strong tendencies, and they orient themselves to the world in aversive ways. They kind of look for what's bad. Some people have strong dispositions towards desire, and they look for all the things that are wonderful and just kind of get this. So subject and object and the activity between them turn out to be somewhat complex. I think you can go on and on like this and analyze a simple statement like I hit the bell and find layers and layers of complexity in how the mind constructs itself, constructs reality, constructs how it sees things. So how does this relate to mindfulness and to meditation? One of the things it relates to is that mindfulness is the practice of beginning to see clearly what is. And one of the things that is, one of the things that exists, is this this construction process, the activity of the mind that constructs its reality to some degree. And normally in life, as people go around daily life activities, this happens so fast that we don't really understand very well that it's even happening. And we assume that the bell is a bell. Of course. Who wants to take the time to analyze it any differently? It's basically a bell anyway here in IMC, so leave me alone. But so it's innocent enough with saying, bell. But there are a lot of situations in life where it's not so innocent. And lots of situations where it tends to cause a lot of suffering if we hold on to a view or project a view onto how things are. So mindfulness is learning to see clearly. As the mindfulness starts to get stronger, and as the concentration gets stronger so the mind is stiller, we can see more and more clearly how this construction process happens. So that you're sitting quietly, minding your own business, maybe in an empty room, and someone walks in through the door. And you can actually watch in the mind as the mind constructs a view, an opinion, a picture, an idea of who that person is. You can actually watch that happen. Normally, when life is really busy, we don't see it happening. And sometimes we assume we know who that person is. Well, that's, that person's whatever. That's it. You kind of have a very quickly formed opinion. I'm a good people reader. I know who people are. And I figured that out who that person is. That person's not safe for me to be with. Or whatever. So the opinion, the view, the construction that's created in the mind is thought to be real. But if you can watch very clearly the construction process happening and see that it's something that's happening in your own mind. Someone walks in and say the person is really tall, big, tall, Jack Bunyan kind of person. You're big, tall, stand 7 feet tall, big biceps, strong, bulging muscles, and I don't know what, tattoos just making this up, and 7 feet tall, And the mind creates a picture. That's a dangerous person. That person is a jock. That person shouldn't be here. That person, that is a person who, you can fill in the blank. Well, better than I can. and you can watch how the mind, these threads, these thoughts, these ideas, these stories arise in the mind. And then you are seeing through those stories. And that's very different than just seeing a tall, strong, big person and then, not knowing what it is, waiting to find out. The mind has a very strong tendency to construct. I don't think you can expect it to stop, your mind doing that. But it's possible to see very clearly that it's doing it. And to see the difference between the person and the story that we've created, the ideas that we've created. If a police officer pulls you over, then the mind will construct a police officer. And that's accurate enough. That's what you're expected to do. But it is a role that you're participating in creating and holding for the duration when it's useful. But one of the coaches in my son's Little League team last year was a Redwood City police officer. And he generally didn't come to practice in his uniform. Once he did. But he came just regularly, dressed as regular kind of folk. And it didn't really seem appropriate to kind of live in this view. This is a police officer, and sir, sir, can I say something, please, sir? he would have gotten angry, I bet, if I kept him in that role. So if you can see and watch how the mind creates this stuff, it gives you a tremendous ability or power or leverage not to get caught in that world of socially created reality, of mentally created reality. It's phenomenally powerful if we can turn the mirror around, turn the awareness back to ourselves, and see how we do that for ourselves, how we construct a view, an idea of who we are, can watch it arise. So if you have some situation in life where you get really calm, really quiet, really still, it could be meditation, it could be other things, other ways, and then pay very careful attention at how your sense of who you are gets recreated, gets reborn, remade. And so you can see that it's arbitrary, or it's based on all kinds of assumptions, maybe assumptions which are not valid, assumptions of stability, of permanence, ideas, this is who I am, this is what I need, this is what has to happen. Or someone steps into the room, and someone you know, and part of what rises up in your mind is the stories of your relationship in the past. There are certainly are stories, things that happened in the past. But the mind has to remind itself of those stories, and then we start seeing through the filter of those stories. Is that necessary? Is it necessary to see someone based on what happened in the past? It can be useful, but it's not, maybe not necessary. And sometimes it's a great burden on ourselves and on the other person to see them based on past stories. And it's something the mind does. It's not inherent in reality that we have to see the situation or see the person through old stories. The story maker in our mind has to reconstruct the story. What if you don't do it? What if you see the person fresh and new, the situation fresh and new? And I know some people have been able to do very deep forgiveness practices where they've forgiven people of what they've done in the past so that the story is still true, but they're not buying into the story anymore. They don't have to do anything with the story. It just arises and they kind of put it aside. Sometimes vipassana practice, the insight meditation practice, especially if it's done on retreat, is understood to be a deconstruction process where there's these layers and layers and layers of constructions that we have created, put together to create our sense of self or sense of reality. And they all require activity of the mind. The mind has to function, be active in order to create all these things. And as the mind relaxes more and more deeply, gets stiller and stiller in meditation, then it kind of starts kind of like at the top layer and relaxes it and relaxes that activity, and we stop doing it. We let go of it temporarily. We let go of it and let go of it. And part of that process is beginning to understand some of the deeper structure of how we've constructed our reality or ourselves. And so we kind of go deeper and deeper, and it can be a big surprise to discover some of the deeper structures that we didn't even know were there, but have to be there where this stuff gets higher up on the structure. And so the mind gets stiller and stiller and stiller. And sometimes it's quite hard to let the mind become really still because some of the structures, some of the constructs we have are considered to be phenomenally important. We're not willing to let go of them. It's frightening to let go of them because it's disorienting. If I don't have this kind of view, this idea of what reality is or who I am, then who am I? And it's frightening not to be anybody. But if you let the mind relax and relax and relax, really relax so it becomes really, really still, completely still, it's possible to come to a place where the mind is no longer involved in the activity of constructing things, no longer constructing anything at all. There's a great sense of freedom in that place, great sense of peace in that place. It's a great place of rest. It's exhausting to be making reality. It's exhausting to recreate ourselves all the time. It's a great sense of rest, but also it gives us a vantage point to watch very carefully how we do the reconstruction process, how we rebuild. And rebuild we have to do. Reality requires us to rebuild. When you leave here today, one of the things that hopefully you will rebuild is the view that when you come to intersections and there's a red light, that means stop. That's a story we tell ourselves. There's nothing inherent in reality that has to be there. But we have to create that story and we participate in that story. And if you don't participate in it, then you have to participate in the story about police officers. And if you don't participate in that, then you have to participate in the story about jails. And you know, so it goes. You know, we're expected to participate in a certain degree of social constructs. Some of it's useful. and some of it has a place. But to see it as that gives us a sense of being freer or more playful or more creative in how we use it and how we play with it. It also can give, if you get a really clear sense of how much of our reality is, or our sense of reality, our view of reality, is an activity of the mind, reality can sometimes seem very dreamlike. Some people say like an illusion, but like a dream. Because as you see how much you can watch, almost these stories, ideas being woven and created and projected and painted everywhere, and you kind of say, wow. You know, it just so much of it is this kind of dreamlike world of mental creations that I'm making and projecting and doing. So one of the functions of Buddhist meditation practice is to help this process of deconstruction to see things more clearly. But it's also to help us to overcome certain mental activities, certain views, certain stories the mind makes, which are considered not accurate. And one of the primary ones that our tradition focuses on is overcoming the unhelpful view of stability and permanence. We don't need to carry with us, we don't have to construct a view that things are permanent in the way that we often construct it. Self, for example, some idea of a permanent abiding self. This is, I really know who I am now. Have you ever tried reading a book that you read 30 years ago or 25 years ago or something that you thought was the best, and then seeing a movie? I remember seeing a movie, I thought that was the funniest. I mean, I remember it being hysterics. And then 25 years later looking at it and saying, what? this is too painful, I don't even want to watch the end of it. So is it the movie that changed? Or is it me? So to overcome the idea of a fixed, permanent sense of self is one of the things that's very freeing, at least according to the Buddhist tradition. Very freeing not to hold oneself down, to limit oneself by that kind of permanent viewpoint. One of the consequences of letting go or relaxing the view of permanence, or the view of a permanent self, abiding self, is it tends to remove a barrier between ourselves and our hearts, or between ourselves and other people and their hearts, or between our hearts and other people's hearts. To relax a sense of permanence and begin to kind of see more clearly what's really there tends to create a much deeper sense of connectedness between people. And there's a level of connectedness, a level of empathy, a level of caring, a level of hearts resonating with each other that has very little to do with the social constructs or the mental constructs of the mind creates. The more we can be free from all the ideas that the mind paints reality with, it doesn't mean we have to get rid of them, but not caught by them, the more clear channels there can be for movements of the heart between people. In fact, in some schools of Buddhism, they say that when the mind understands the emptiness of it all, or has a deep experience of emptiness, that comes together with a deep sense of love or compassion or caring. That emptiness and compassion are so closely related that perhaps they're indistinguishable in a certain way, maybe two sides of the same coin. So this isn't just mental gymnastics, you know, to kind of understand how language is and how we construct reality and all that. But rather, it's an attempt to understand so that we can become free and so that we can live a life that's more deeply connected to our hearts, to a free heart, to a radiant heart, to an open heart. One of the very powerful things about the deconstruction process of when this practice is done really thoroughly, like on a retreat, is to deconstruct and deconstruct so far that you realize that you're happiness, your sense of well-being, your sense of freedom. That I'll say it this way, that there is a place of freedom or happiness or well-being that's not dependent on anything. You know, anything like a subject-object kind of thing, relationship. You know, not dependent on our job or our house or our relationships with other people or our health or our recreational opportunities or, you know, not dependent on many things that people think they need to have in order to be happy. Not dependent on status, not dependent on being loved. There's a kind of deep, deep abiding sense of peace that's available that, in a sense, is not dependent on anything. And that requires a kind of deconstruction process to find that. And then once we find that, then I think we can come back into the reconstruction process with a very different attitude about what we're reconstructing. We can hold it lighter. We don't have to hold on, grasp so tightly to everything. We have to hold it lightly. Oh, for right now, I have a role. For right now, my role tonight is to be the teacher. And some of you are now realizing exactly 9 o'clock. And they think, you know, Gail better get off that role because it's 9 o'clock. I've given him permission to have that role until 9 o'clock without 1 minute beyond that. So I should stop, right? So I hope this has been provocative and interesting and useful. And I hope it challenges you to begin over this next week to kind of begin questioning how you see things. And can you begin questioning and seeing the degree to which you are participating in creating what you see out there? Or say it differently, to challenge you to see how is it that you're painting yourself or painting the world out there? And does it have to be that way? Could it be a different way? Okay? Thank you.